the Tudor Hair Story. Today I am talking to Amanda Chiavo, author of Book in Her Own Right, a novel about Mary the First. Today we are talking about Mary the First, but also the myths of Mary the First. Let's delve into the episode. Hello Amanda, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's my absolute pleasure. So you are the author of the indie novel In Her Own Right, a novel of Mary the First. And today we're very aptly talking about Mary and also the myths surrounding Mary in later, well, in her time and post-death. But firstly, I thought we could talk a little bit about yourself. So firstly, what got you into Tudor history?
My mom, actually. When I was in middle school, she had given me a copy of Mistress Anne, a biography of Anne Boleyn by Carolee Erickson. And I was hooked. I was so hooked after that. I remember going up to her, being like holding the book and being like, he killed her, like he killed her like that. And she was like, yes. So I couldn't, my tiny little middle school brain, like couldn't get it. And she was like, don't think about it too much right now.
No,
of course
I
had to.
I think it is like, it's like, wait, what? She dies at the end? Spoiler, Anne dies at the end.
Spoiler alert.
But it is one of those, because I think I was the same. It was like, wait, he killed not one, but two? What's going on with this guy?
Yeah, seriously.
Why is the Tudor era still your favourite today?
There's so much to unpack in the Tudor era. It's this element of, there's the human element and the psychological element of everything happening, everything that happened across the, 118 years that the Tudors ruled England. And, you know, when you're a child, you have this romantic Disney almost idea of kings and queens and princes and princesses. And, you know, the reality of it's not that at all. And I just think that's endlessly fascinating. The Tudors themselves are endlessly fascinating individuals. They are flawed, they are selfish, they are egotistical, they are entitled. They're also kind and charitable and devout. And each has this belief that no matter what their actions are, they're doing the right thing because it's what God wanted and it's what their people need. And sitting here in the 21st century, I think it's just like an endlessly fascinating mindset to try to understand.
No, I completely agree. I think why I like the Tudors so much is they're almost relatable. They're kind of, they're not so far away, it's ancient, but they're far away enough that, you know, you can't, don't actually know what they fully look like. I mean, Henry VIII, you know, he didn't want to be with Anne of Cleves because he didn't fully know who she was. Because he hadn't picked her, and that's such a modern thing
Absolutely.
Compared to falling for Anne or Jane or any of the other wives. It's such a modern thing to do.
Yes.
But that's why I'm obsessed with them. I just think they're amazing to research. Yeah.
No, same. It really, and it is, like you look at it and you think that some of this, not all of it, but some of this could be happening today. Some of these are very modern problems.
No, completely. I know it's not, well, it is, but you know these TV series, The Tudors, and it's the sweat and sickness episode. I watched that, I think, about a year ago, and I was like, well, this resonates today.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's so wild, too. You think about that episode and the history of that in general, and you think, well, we don't have to worry about that. We're sitting here in these modern times, and we have all of these wonderful scientific medical advancements, and then everything that happened from 2020 onward, and you just think, oh wow, I mean, as bad as it was for us, how were people back then even dealing with it? It's so endlessly fascinating to think about.
No, I agree. So when did you know that you were going to write a Tudor novel?
Well, professionally, I am a writer and a journalist, and I had always hoped that at some point in my career, I would write a novel. I wasn't sure what that novel would look like until maybe 5 years ago. I love Alison Weir. She is my favorite, favorite, favorite historical fiction writer. And I loved her book, The Lady Elizabeth. It's my favorite historical Tudor novel. And I really, really, really wanted to read something like that from Mary's point of view. And there's not that many out there where she's the protagonist or where she's portrayed in a more balanced and nuanced and understanding, morally gray kind of light. So I thought, maybe I can do this. Maybe I, you know, rather than waiting for someone to write the book, what if I sat down and did it? And I remember very vividly sitting down and writing out the first sentence. And this memory is so clear. I thought to myself, you're never going to finish this. And then what did it take me? 3 years later, it's being published and I'm talking about it on podcasts and I'm doing social media for it. And it's just so wild.
I mean, I think it's an absolutely wonderful book and I urge all of my listeners to read it. I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
I mean, I find it so irritating when you do read about Mary. It's this really dark light and she's not given the same complexity that her father's given, personally. And mm-hmm. I think your book really does that well.
Thank you.
Because she's not simple.
She's not simple. I think that is part of the myth of Bloody Mary. And for whatever reason, people have a very hard time looking at Mary as a complex human being. And we absolutely need to hold Mary accountable for the things that she did during her reign. But that's not to say that we can't step back and look at the whole person and understand who she was and look at her more balanced. Because I think one of the things that kind of makes me crazy is the way Henry VIII is portrayed all the time, young and virile and athletic. And, you know, you do have portrayals of him being sort of bigger and more monstrous, but it's still not quite, if you were to compare some of the portrayals of Henry VIII to, say, the portrayal of Mary in the first Elizabeth movie with Cate Blanchett, very, very wildly different interpretations. And I don't know, it feels like Mary's held to a very strange standard that we're not holding other people who did equally reprehensible things to, especially Henry.
No, I agree. I think it's kind of Elizabeth, who again is another complex, brilliant woman who did some arguably terrible things during her reign, but she's not criticized the same as Mary is for the 5 years she reigned.
Yes. Imagine somebody only focusing on the worst 5 years of your life, and that's your legacy going forward. And again, not making excuses, not condoning at all. Mary absolutely has to be held accountable for what she did. So does Elizabeth, so does Henry, so does Edward, so does James I of Scotland, who, talk about somebody who was burning people at a whim. He burned something like 4,000 quotes witches during his time. So, yeah.
Could you tell us who Mary is and the bit of the background to her?
Yeah, absolutely. So if I were going to use one word to describe Mary, that word would be complex. And, you know, Mary, she was a woman of incredible character, resilience, and courage. She was very kind-hearted, but she was also flawed. She was single-minded to the point of her own detriment. She, you know, one of the things that really shaped who she was, you know, as a person, as an adult, was the King's Great Matter. People tend to forget, I think, that she was a child on the cusp of adolescence when Henry VIII decided, I'm divorcing her mother, I'm breaking with the church that you, Mary, have been raised to believe is the be-all, the end-all, nobody's above the Pope, you know, XYZ. You know, she was very young. She was on the cusp of adolescence. And those years really shaped who she was. And the one constant in her life at that point was her Catholic faith. So she grabbed onto that with both hands, and she was not going to let go.
The Catholic faith, I think, was really important to Mary, and we obviously see that in the later years of her life. Mm-hmm. But I think a really pivotal moment is when Catherine of Aragon dies in 1536, and she sees the Catholic faith is the only thing that's not let her down. Because mm-hmm. by this point, her father's completely let her down, and I think she knows mm-hmm. there's no way going back, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a brief period where she thinks, once Anne Boleyn is executed, there might be a bit mm-hmm. of a change. And when she realises he's not going to, I think mm-hmm. that's when she's like, oh, okay, yeah, you're going to carry on.
Mm-hmm. I think that was a really, really rude awakening for Mary. It was the downfall of Anne Boleyn. And then there wasn't that instant, everything was back to normal. And I actually, there's a scene in my novel where I play on that, where Mary is sitting in her garden, you know, just enjoying the day. And Shakwe comes to her, and this is purely fictionalized. Shakwe comes to her and says, this is everything that's happening. And there's a moment in the scene, Mary sort of sits back and goes, it's over. It's over. My father's going to welcome me back to court. You know, the witch is gone. If only my mother was still alive. And I have Shakwe kind of look at her very sort of almost looking at her in sort of a pathetic kind of light. Like, why you don't understand that this is, it's not going to go back to normal. You know, your father, he's started down this road and he's not going to change. And you are the one who's going to have to submit. And in that moment, in the book, she's very just so relieved. And then almost the next scene I have is when someone comes to visit her, and there's that very famous confrontation where the man tells her, if you were my daughter, I would smash your head like a boiled apple. And that is in the novel. And I think in real life, Mary kind of, that's when she realizes I'm still in danger, and she signs the oath. And she never forgives herself for doing that. She never, ever, ever forgives herself for what she considers the ultimate betrayal of her mother.
No, you're completely right. I think it's Thomas Howard that says it. I think it's Thomas Howard that says it. And I think, obviously, she probably still believed it even up to her death, purely out of principle, that it was Anne Boleyn that was the reason why everything mm-hmm. went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a brief moment when she realised it wasn't Anne Boleyn that mm-hmm. was causing the whole problems, she realised her dad was the problem. I think that must have been such a hard thing to realise as a young woman. Your mm-hmm. dad's the problem.
Yeah, and especially this is a point, your dad is the king, and this is a point in time. Everything must have been so confusing for her, because this is a point in time where you're told the king, you know, this is God's anointed, you know, advisor on earth, or not advisor, that was the wrong word, but God chose this person to be king, and you have to listen to what he's saying. But what he's saying is directly in conflict with everything you've ever been taught by your father. And Mary, another thing about her personality is that she had this kind of innocence about her, because she was very isolated for a very long time. So I think that also kind of like played into her naivety, you know, about her father. And one thing that kind of always gets me, if we jump a few hundred years into the future and we're talking about Queen Victoria, one of the first things that people always say about her is she was a bad mother. Why don't we ever talk about the fact that Henry VIII was a bad father? Because he was a bad father.
He was such a bad father. He calls Mary his pearl, I think. Is it his pearl of the world? Yeah, mm-hmm. the pearl of his world. And then treats her like utter crap. Mm-hmm. There's no other way to say it. That no is just it.
Mm-hmm.
And he does the exact same to Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
And then Edward, he completely shelters from the whole world. And he only thinks about himself in the process.
No, exactly. He's only thinking about himself in the process. He's an incredibly selfish human being.
What are some of the myths about Mary you would like to dispel today?
There's a bunch. But the most important thing is the myth of Bloody Mary. you know, there was so much more to this woman than the religious persecutions of her reign. And, you know, it's, again, it's the only thing that we focus on. And I understand that from, you know, the human perspective. It was an incredible amount of violence. Again, we have to hold Mary accountable for what she did, but that doesn't mean that we have to erase the other things that were good about her. So we know that Mary executed almost 300 people during the 5 years of her reign. And again, it was an incredible amount of violence squished into a very short amount of time. Whereas if you compare her reign to Henry VIII or Elizabeth, it's still an incredible amount of violence, but it's stretched out over a longer period of time. So there's things that are happening in between. And I also, what's interesting is the first year of Mary's reign was relatively tranquil. The burnings don't start until a year or so after her reign begins. In the first year, with the exception of the Wyatt Rebellion and like a few other things that pop up, her reign, the first year of her reign is relatively tranquil, and people were very excited for her to be their queen. They'd always, even people who are of the new faith looked at Mary like the rightful heir. Over the course of the almost 40-year reign that Henry is on the throne, it's estimated that he executed between 52 and 72,000 people. It's very possible that those numbers are exaggerated, but the fact that when you look for the numbers, that's what comes up, tells you a lot about the violence that was going on during his reign. Elizabeth, those numbers are a little bit harder to come by. I keep seeing conflicting numbers about the number of executions that happened during Elizabeth's reign, because it isn't something that we tend to focus on. But from what I've seen in my research, it's at least 1,000 people. And we do know that in 1569, there was a rebellion against Elizabeth by the Catholic nobility in Northern England. And in the aftermath, she has somewhere between 400 and 700 people executed as traitors. And that is a very, very brutal death. Mary, on the other hand, was a little bit more merciful. She showed mercy to many of the rebels who were part of the Wyatt Rebellion in early 1554. Of the 480 rebels convicted, 90 are executed and another 280 are pardoned. So that's definitely, I think, the myth of Bloody Mary needs to be laid to rest. You know, with the burnings that happened under Mary, a lot of the time, I think the popular legend is that Mary did this completely out of vengeance. And historian Dr. Gregory Slies argues that that is not the case, with the exception of Thomas Cranmer's situation. That was vengeance. That was revenge. I think we all know that. And I think even Cranmer had to know he probably wasn't going to survive Mary's reign. But Dr. Slies argues that the typical theme of vengeance doesn't fit with Mary's personality, and noted that the majority of those who have been investigated for suspicion of heresy were eventually released. He makes the argument in his biography of Mary that, these people were interrogated pretty thoroughly, and Mary wouldn't have done that if she wasn't hoping that they would either A, recant, or be proven innocent. You know, she wasn't looking to just send everyone and anyone to their deaths. You know, I think the thing that can be argued about Mary versus some of the other Tudors, especially her father, is she had genuine concern for the souls of her people, which sitting here in 2024 is kind of a strange thing to think about. But in that time period, from the moment you were born, your main concern had to be securing your afterlife. And Mary did not, you know, as misguided as her beliefs were, she did not want her people suffering what she expected them to suffer as Protestants, as quote, heretics, which would have been an eternity of flames. The other thing that Dr. Slies argues, which I thought was really interesting, was that a lot of the accusations were kind of the result of human pettiness. So like family disputes, spouses would inform on unfaithful partners. Children would accuse parents following arguments over their inheritance. You know, neighbors would accuse neighbors over the smallest issue. And it's so funny, as I was reading that, I kept thinking about the Salem witch trials. And I was like, wow, this has been a human characteristic in every time period. You know, it was really, really interesting to think about that, about the burnings and the accusations as situations of that nature. I thought that was really, really, really fascinating. So yeah, I feel like I've been babbling, but this idea that Mary was this bloody tyrant just needs to go. And there's this saying from this old film from the 1960s, like a cowboy movie that my dad used to watch, that says, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. And I think that's where we are with Mary. The legend of Bloody Mary has become fact versus the truth of who she actually was.
No, I mean, I agree. I think obviously there was devastation in her reign, but it's been, I'm trying to think of the word, it's been catastrophized a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Than it was, because obviously you've got the decision of monasteries in her father's reign, and you also have the Pilgrimage of Grace in her father's reign, which was absolutely devastating. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no way to describe it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing too is Henry and Elizabeth were both proponents of using the traitor's death, which we all know is just such a brutal way to go. I mean, it's apples and oranges. You can't compare one to the other, but that was something that they both utilized a lot. And Elizabeth, again, Elizabeth had the benefit of learning from Mary's mistakes. Mary went after heretics, and heretic is in the eye of the beholder. Elizabeth went after traitors. And everyone can agree on what a traitor is. And if you look at Elizabeth's reign, most of those, quote, traitors were Catholic.
Would you say that the reason why Mary persecutes so much wasn't actually because of her? Because I see, from what I've read myself, that it was actually her advisors that pushed her to do a lot. Would you say that is probably the case?
I would agree with that in part. Mary definitely had the final say, but you know, she was surrounded by people who looked at Henry's Reformation, looked at Edward's reign as, you know, again, heretic, going against God, going against the church. So she definitely had people around her pushing her towards certain things. And I've read in a few different sources that at the beginning, Mary and Stephen Gardiner weren't expecting to burn as many as they did. They thought that it would be more of a deterrent, but what ends up happening again and again, because you have people who are so fervent on both sides, being a Protestant then sort of becomes this sort of anti-government thing. And so the burnings kind of perpetuate, like, I'm going to stand up and be against the government for my faith. And again, it's such a faith-driven society. And it's, so I think, it's, again, sitting here in the 21st century, we kind of look at people who live by faith more than I think within the norm as sort of outliers, and kind of step back and say, oh, you know, we throw the word cult around a lot, I think, in the 21st century. And so it's hard to kind of reconcile that with what was going on, but it was such a faith-based community. And so many people, whether they were Catholic or Protestant, were very, very willing to stand up and say, I will die for my faith, because that's what I need to do. And so yeah, going back to your original question, yeah, there were definitely people who urged Mary to move more cautiously. There were people who urged Mary to move much harder than she did. One of the things that actually they urged Mary to do in the very beginning is not renounce the title of head of the Church of England, which is something she absolutely hated. She wanted to do that right away, but her advisors urged her not to do that right away. And she does kind of wait and slowly, as she's returning to Rome, kind of gets rid of that title. So yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, she had people on both sides who were pushing her one way or the other, but ultimately the final decision was hers.
No, I think it's really interesting of you to say that, because I think, obviously, when you see some portrayals, you see the Spanish ambassador going in her ear, going, you know, kill Elizabeth, kill Jane. Mm-hmm. And I think it's either it was all Mary or it was all the council or the Spanish advisor. It's not a mix.
Mm-hmm.
Almost, it's got to be one or the other.
Yeah. And I think that's a mistake that Mary makes, is being way too influenced by Spain. And I understand it, because it was her mother's country, and, you know, Charles was in her corner for a very long time. Chapuis was in her corner for a very long time, but she was, I think, just too influenced by Spain. And she did rely very heavily on the ambassador, Simon Renard. And I think we can also say that her decision to marry Philip probably was not one of her best.
No, I agree. Would you say there is a myth surrounding Mary that she was a bad queen?
I would definitely. Yeah, there's this idea that she was just, just a bad queen, plain and simple, and that she left England in financial, parliamentary, and military ruins, which, wasn't true. She, not that, there's this myth also that Elizabeth inherited a realm that was just in catastrophe, which is not 100% true. There were definitely things that Elizabeth had to fix. But there were things that Mary did. She invested in building up the English Navy. She started to reform the country's finances through acts that impacted trade, improved the situations of different merchants. Unfortunately, she doesn't have the chance to see that through before her death in 1558. What else is going on? Actually, I have Dr. Sly's book right in front of me, and there's a paragraph that I'd like to read, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just think it's really interesting to look at Mary as queen. So it starts, "Of similar long-lasting importance was Mary's active support for the development of what Robert Tytler called a national urban policy. Under Henry VIII, ad hoc schemes were initiated to address specific urban difficulties, but under Mary, a consistent policy was developed to deal with a variety of issues from depopulation to unemployment. For instance, initiatives like the Retail Trade Act of 1554, the Weavers Act of 1555, and the Woolen Cloth Act of 1557 prioritized towns over the countryside in the production of cloth in order to rejuvenate decayed, destroyed, and depopulated urban areas, further reinforcing the central government's support for the privileges of corporate towns and boroughs. Was the Militia Act of 1558, which made towns and boroughs directly accountable to the crown for the mustering of their inhabitants. The enduring impact of the Marian naval reform should also be acknowledged, which not only enabled the country to confront France effectively between 1557 and 1559, but also laid the foundation for Elizabeth's naval endeavors." So the Marian administration generally worked well, which belies the claim that emerged after her death that she left Elizabeth with, quote, a chaotic and rudderless system. So I just that passage always pops out to me whenever I go back and look at this biography.
No, I think that's really interesting, because I think, obviously, I've read it as well, that Elizabeth inherits a really destitute England. Mm-hmm. But I think Mary also inherits a very destitute England. And I think Edward inherited a really destitute England, because Henry VIII spent a lot more than he could actually spend. You actually read it, and I can't remember who wrote it now, but Henry VII leaves a really wealthy England. Amazing. And Henry VIII pretty much spends it all in the first 6 years of his reign.
It's so funny how opposite Henry and his father are, because you could probably describe Henry VII as a little bit miserly, whereas Henry VIII was just spending, 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 spending. And I think that goes back to what we talked about earlier about Henry just being selfish, and he had all this money and he was going to spend it, and he was the prince and he was the king and da 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 da. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be different though. And again, very modern kind of interpretation. I'm not going to do anything the same way my father did. You know, I'm different than my dad.
No, I agree. Would you say there's a myth surrounding Mary and her husband, Philip? Would you want to go into that myth a little bit?
Absolutely. This is another one that kind of grinds my gears a little bit. there's this other myth, yeah, that Mary was just fawning over her husband night and day, whatever he said. She was so in love to the point of, like, you know, her mind was clouded. False. It is a very, very one-sided marriage. Mary definitely does fall in love with her husband. Philip is 11 years younger than Mary. You know, he'd already been married once. He already had children. You know, had mistresses. So he looked at his marriage to Mary as being more, this is my duty. I'm going to do this because my father wants me to. I'm going to be the next king of Spain and da 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 da. And there is this myth that Mary was just, you know, head over heels for her husband, and it just clouded her mind. Again, that's not true. The marriage treaty, which not only she approved, she actually assigned one of her advisors, I forget if it was Gardner or somebody else, but somebody who was vocal against her, who didn't want her to marry Philip, she put him in charge of drawing up the marriage treaty so it would be fair and had England's best interests at heart. And one of the things that was very clear in this treaty, which Mary approved, is that Mary the sovereign and Mary Philip's wife would be two separate people. You know, Mary did have that belief that a woman should be submissive to her husband, but she was not afraid of excluding him from political decisions, and she did.
No, I agree. I don't know if you've heard of him. It's his name's Peter Stifel, and he looks into the iconography of Mary. Oh. And you can actually see in the work he was talking about, he's done an episode with Natalie Gruniger on her podcast ages ago. And he says in most of the iconography of Mary the First, she's got the dominance. If there's anything with Philip, it's her. She is saying she is the queen regnant. Philip is the consort of May. He has no authority in England. And I think that is so interesting to learn, because it's in everything you see. Mary falls in love with Philip and then that's it. She misses him when he's gone. And it just spins from there, and it just goes into a tree with a, like, you just take total into the tree.
Yeah,
narrative.
Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, I have to look into that, what you were saying. Yeah, I have to look into that and definitely listen to that episode of the podcast. But no, it's so true. And that she, there's this view of her just being this sort of like kind of pathetic creature when it comes to this relationship. And again, people are forgetting, you know, when Philip leaves England, Mary had just suffered through her first false pregnancy. She's embarrassed, she's humiliated, she's dealing with the trauma of that. She's got to figure, she's convinced that her sister might be plotting against her. She's got to deal with the succession. She's hurt, and her husband just leaves. So yeah, you're going to be sad and depressed about all of those things. You know, the husband leaving is going to be the tip of the iceberg. There's a scene in Elizabeth with Glinda Jackson, where Mary and Philip are having a conversation, and Philip says something about leaving, and Mary just leaps up from the chair that she's in. She runs over to him, she falls to her knees, and she's holding on to him. It's a very, very pathetic sight. And it's just what's become popular. It's the legend that has become fact about Mary. And it's, again, one of these things that, yes, she was in love with her husband and it was one-sided, but it wasn't to that degree. There were so many other things happening to Mary at the time that resulted in her anxiety and depression and the last, you know, really sad few years of her life.
No, I agree. I think that time was different. You weren't so public with your emotion. You know, at the end of the day, she truly believed from the day of her father's annulment she was a princess of England and Spain. No one is going to see how I publicly feel like that. I don't think she would degrade herself like that. And I think it's a shame that people have such a fixed view on Mary when it comes to this.
And yeah, I mean, exactly what you said about not showing her emotions. She shuts herself away for a while. And she gets a lot of criticism for that. And then if you go back to her father's reign, Henry shuts himself away after the death of Jane Seymour. He doesn't get criticism for that, you know, but Mary does. She shuts herself away after the false pregnancy. And, you know, we look at it again from the 21st century. We could say this woman needed time to grieve. She needed time on her own. But at that point in time, that was not something that was even considered. And so she gets a lot of flack for shutting herself away.
No, she does. Would you say that the loss of Calais is another thing that completely destroys Mary's reputation?
Yeah, I think so. And that goes back to the thing with her being so dependent on her husband. Mary actually had her own reasons for wanting to go to war with France. And so her husband asking her to join in the war is kind of like, okay, yeah, now I can finally do this. Because the King of France at the time, Henry II, was sort of baiting Mary in a few different ways. And so with Philip wanting to go to war with Spain, she says, okay, let's do this. And unfortunately, it does result in the loss of Calais in 1558, which is a huge blight on Mary's reputation. And something that genuinely broke Mary's heart, she very famously says that if they ever opened up her coffin after her death, they would find Calais on her heart. And another thing that's kind of interesting is when Elizabeth becomes queen, she decides she's going to take back Calais, but she fails miserably at that. And nobody really even talks about that attempt of Elizabeth taking back Calais.
No, and I think that's the kind of the crux of the conversation is Mary is not given the same time and thought as any other Tudor monarch. It's not just Elizabeth, it's any other monarch. She is not given the same dignity that the others get.
Yep, I would absolutely agree with that.
I would like to ask, why did you want to write your book on Mary the First?
My desire to write about Mary came from wanting to read about her. You know, like I said earlier, I wanted to read a novel where Mary was the main character, where her story is being told in a more balanced and nuanced way that really got to the heart of who she was. And so rather than waiting for someone else to write it, I decided to do it. And it's really funny because I'm in the process of writing my sequel, and Alison Weir has come out with her own novel of Mary, and I want to read it so badly, but I refuse to read any books, any novels about Mary until my sequel is in the hands of my publisher and just out of my control, because I don't want to be influenced or anything like that. But it's sitting on my shelf and I keep staring at it, and I'm like, don't open it, don't open it, don't open it.
No, I think I think you'll enjoy it. It's a good book. So you've just mentioned a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know when it could possibly come out?
Oh no, unfortunately I'm a slow writer. Not as slow as George R. R. Martin, so but I'm a slow writer. I'm taking my time on this one. Because there's a lot more trauma, and it's trauma that I have no experience with. So I'm actually in the point of the book, I've gotten up to Mary's first false pregnancy, and I want to do that justice. I want to make sure that it is accurate to the symptoms, to her specific situation, but then also not, I don't want to be insensitive to anyone who's actually gone through that. It's really wild to read about. I'm reading all of these different things about it. And, you know, Mary was so convinced that she was with child to the point that she could feel the baby move. And it's so fascinating. You read about this and it's such a common symptom. And you just think, oh my gosh. And a little bit of spoilers in the sequel, Mary's convinced she's having a girl and she's going to name the girl Catherine. And she refers to her, she puts her hands on her stomach a lot, and she refers to her little Tudor queen in there. And so I'm getting close to the end. I'm right around the time where she's going to be in her confinement. And I'm not ashamed to say I'm a little bit stumped at this point, because I want to just get this right. And it's really interesting because we talked earlier about having things in common with people who lived hundreds of years ago. And one thing that I have in common with Mary is a very complicated relationship with my dad. So there's a lot of that in the first novel, the complicated relationship between Mary and Henry. There's a lot of mirroring of my own complicated relationship. My father never threatened to have me executed, so that one. But no, just the human dynamic of it. So I had a lot of experience with that, and that was quote easier to write, just based on my own experience. But with this, it's way more difficult. And so I'm definitely going to take my time. And ideally, I would like to have a draft done by the end of the year. So that is my goal. But as far as publication, I'm not 100% sure.
No, I mean, as I said earlier, I love the first one. I will leave a link down below for listeners to purchase this book. I hope to see the second one by next year.
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Before I let you go, I like to ask some fun Tudor questions. So firstly, have you got a Tudor pet peeve?
Two. The Bloody Mary narrative, of course, which we talked in depth about. And then the idea that the story of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn is some sort of tragic love story. it is a tragic story. It's Anne's tragic story. And I think we all know, you know, we've all read our romances. We know that love stories do tend to end in tragedy. I would argue that none of them end with one person decapitating the other. You know, so the love story of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII, that's a pet peeve of mine.
No, I agree. I mean, I think it's complicated because it's not a love story.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there's, all you think about is between them, there must have been such a force, but was it just one-sided? You know, Anne very clearly says no. I mean, I make no secret about it. I'm a big Anne Boleyn supporter and I love her. So I read it as she didn't relent. She chose to agree after a time, but because of peer pressure, she felt she had to agree.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, she goes back to Hever for, I don't even remember how long, what, a year? To get away from Harry.
She goes back a year, and I think she goes back multiple times to escape this. Because I think, personally, I think she had a very big sense of loyalty to Catherine of Aragon. And I think that's quite overlooked. And I'm trying to find more into that connection between the two women, because I think there's a lot more between them than people like to believe. But no, I completely agree with you. It is not a love story. It's not a love story. The more I think about it, I'm like...
Yeah, it's definitely not. Yeah.
Have you got a favorite Tudor book? It can be non-fiction or fiction.
Fiction, and it is Lady Elizabeth by Alison Weir.
Perfect. And finally, have you got a favorite historical film?
I do. I have two. One is Tudor. It's Anne of a Thousand Days. I think it's just a brilliant, brilliant film. And then my favorite historical fiction film overall is actually not Tudor related at all. It's called Lincoln. It's a Steven Spielberg movie, and Daniel Day-Lewis stars as President Abraham Lincoln, and it's his fight to get the 13th Amendment passed before the Confederate Army agrees to any kind of surrender or peace treaty or anything. It's his fight to get the 13th Amendment passed before the Confederacy gives up. And it's just an endlessly fascinating film about a really tumultuous time in American history.
No, I agree. I mean, I know it's a final question, but I just thought I've got to ask this. Have you got a favorite portrayal of Mary the First?
Yes. Romola Garrari, I believe I said her last name right, in the show Becoming Elizabeth. I'm so mad we're not getting a second season of that show. I just thought Mary was portrayed so brilliantly and very balanced. You could see her struggle with her faith and her loyalty to her brother, the king, her very loving and also very tumultuous relationship with her sister, Elizabeth. And I just thought it was such a brilliant portrayal of Mary the person versus, they very easily could have just gone the Bloody Mary route and had her just been this very stone cold, very stone cold, sterile, sort of unfeeling character. But we get a very balanced portrayal of Mary. And I loved, loved, loved it.
No, I absolutely love that. It wasn't my favourite show. I've got to admit that. I feel like I'm going to get a lot of hate for that, because I felt it was more Becoming Mary, which I love. I absolutely love that portrayal. But I did not like Elizabeth in it at all. And I don't know why.
Agree. Yeah, no, there's something, it's something about her portrayal, I think, is a little, But I think also, I think it kind of goes back to, she's very young in that show, and like it's her adolescence, and it's so funny to sit here because we talk about the adults so much. We talk about Bloody Mary, we talk about Gloriana the Queen, we talk, you know, it's easy to forget that they were children at one point, which is so fascinating to think about.
Before I let you go, my final favorite is, and there's not many to like when it comes to Mary the First, sadly, is Sarah Bolger. I thought she did a really good job. And I thought, oh yeah, she's the top. And then you see, obviously, Romola Garrari, is it? And it's just like, okay, you go to the top. Yep. It's fine.
For sure.
Thank you so much for coming on today. It has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you about your book, and your passion for Mary shines through so much. So thank you for coming on today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is fantastic.
If you enjoyed this episode and you loved all the others, please take the time to rate and review the show.